live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you from all over the world and all of the other stations playing this program today. We're going to talk about light therapy is effective for depression and more from the University of British Columbia, and how a raisin can predict a toddler's future academic ability, University of Warwick, and why canola oil is not the healthiest oil you've been led to believe, and which ones are, which ones should we be cooking with and consuming on our salads and other dishes. And coconut oil does show promise in the prevention of deadly bloodstream infections, Tufts University School of Medicine. And nutrition is the key to ensuring the sustainable development goals in our health, The Guardian, and a lot more on health and healing. I'm going to give a commentary today that is addressing a lot of the issues that are not spoken about in a lot of the media, and I think you'll find them of interest. And they're based upon four recent films that I have watched, that I will share some insights on those films, documentaries principally, and the two that are not documentaries are based upon true events. Also today, my guest in the second part of our program, and I'm devoting a lot of time to it, is Ned Sublette, and he is going to talk about slavery, a look at the history of how the U.S. economy was built upon slavery, and what we don't talk about, the slave breeding industry. A lot of people are unaware of this. Now, also today, we're going to hear some clips about how to respond when someone blames all Muslims for ISIS. And that's a mistake, and we'll put this information out on that. And also, the CIA must stop its illegal, counterproductive war to overthrow Assad, and we'll have a share of that. And I will give my own input on some of the things that we could be doing as a nation, but we first have to be aware of in order to do. So we have a lot to talk about. Let's begin. First up, this is from the University of Warwick, and it says, a simple test using a raisin can predict how well a toddler will perform academically at age 8. Using just the piece of dried fruit in a plastic cup, they have devised a test based on how long a 20-month-old child can wait to pick up a raisin in front of them. The toddlers were given a raisin that was placed under an opaque cup within easy reach. After 3 training runs, toddlers were asked to wait until they were told, 60 seconds, they could touch and eat the raisin. During the study, it was found that those who were born very prematurely were more likely to take the raisin before the allotted time. In a follow on the study, the academics found that those who couldn't inhibit their behavior as toddlers weren't performing as well in school as their full-term peers 7 years later. Senior author Professor Wolf on this stated that an easy 5-minute raisin game test represents a promising new tool for follow-up assessment to predict attention regulation and learning in preterm and term-born children. The results are also point to potential innovative avenues to early intervention after preterm births. This was published in the Journal of Pediatrics. Now, why is this relevant? Because I believe that we have an entire generation of parents today, many of whom, not all, but many of whom virtually do not pay any attention to these developmental issues. They are extraordinarily, mindless when it comes to placing any boundary or any requirement for the child in the way of emotional or intellectual or behavioral discipline. So whatever the child wants, it gets. It doesn't have to be supervised. It may have a nanny, and frequently there are nannies. I always wonder, how does a person expect a child to develop if all you have is time for, or is not the child. You have nannies take care of your child. Exactly what kind of relationship are you expecting this to be? And yet, that's one of the little trophies in their life. Well, I have my career, I have this, I better have a kid now. If you really want a kid, and you have everything else working in your life, why don't you adopt a young man, young woman, who are orphans, be a big brother, big sister, and then as you see the input between yourself and that child evolving, and how your input to that child is helping them, giving them some sense of love and comfort and grounding emotionally that they don't have otherwise, then adopt that child. Or if you see that you're not really the parenting type, that you really are more absorbed in yourself than you could be sharing energy with others, then you realize, all right, you're not that energy. But the worst thing you can do is assume responsibility for bringing a child into this world or taking over the responsibility of being a right father and mother only to not be. And one of the things we don't do in our society, but many other societies, especially Eastern cultures, are very good at this, is a sense of focus and discipline and not having everything be an instant gratification. So by watching these tendencies, we're able to see what is occurring within the child and then work with that in trying to help them. Because then later, they'll do better in school. They'll do better in listening to people. They won't be the person coming into a room and want everyone to hear them instead of being patient. Patience is a virtue virtually non-existent today, everywhere. And I believe that we have got to get back to being patient, compassionate, listening, and not needing every moment to be about us. And you see the results in many of the young people today, or people in their 30s, very selfish, self-absorbed. And those would be people that maybe the parents didn't pay attention and should have. Light therapy is a good therapy. We've known this for a long time. This is the University of British Columbia, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Psychiatry. Quote, new research finds that light therapy can treat non-seasonal depression and improve the overall well-being of people suffering from the disease. Well, A, they're wrong. Depression is not a disease. And B, quote, these results are very exciting because light therapy is inexpensive, easy to access and use, and comes with few side effects. How about no side effects? So typically, light therapy was used back in the 1970s. When people in northern climates, in Norway, in Alaska, in Sweden, where they have very long winter days, where then you have very long dark days. Even the United States right now is getting dark around 4:30. And that throws off some of your cognition of the moment you're in, because if it gets dark that early, sometimes you're thinking it's later than what it is, and it's only 4:45, 5 o'clock. But light therapy has been used for a long time. You simply have that natural full-spectrum light. The key is full-spectrum light in the room where you're at. It doesn't have to be in front of you. It used to be you'd have to sit in front of it for half hour. Not now. You just put full-spectrum light bulbs in your house. That can help you even when you're in a blue mood. And that's good. Definitely recommend it. This is about canola oil. This is from Health Impact News, Roxanne McDonald. Found it interesting. I'll give you my comment on after I read what she says. She says, can a health food eaten by millions really be dangerous? Canola oil and its derivative, rapeseed, are primary suspects for the exceptionally high incidence of Asian lung cancer. According to mainstream media, though, canola oil is good for the heart, offering viable monounsaturated fatty acids similar to olive oil. Sadly, much of what we hear in the mainstream media and various health blogs has been influenced by aggressive marketing tactics of big food companies. For this reason, it's critical to know what websites to avoid and where you can go to get trustworthy and accurate health information. We can trace olive oil back to olives and sesame seeds back to sesame seeds, the oil. So wouldn't it make sense that canola oil would come from canola seeds? Well, it's not the case. There's no natural canola plant that produces canola oil. In the late 1960s, canola oil was invented in Canada. The oil was cheap to manufacture and a dominant ingredient in many processed foods. A derivative of the rapeseed plant, which is part of the mustard family of plants, canola oil has been hybridized to eliminate the lethal uricic acid found in the rapeseed. Olive oil was the product of choice among those who were health conscious. However, it was quite expensive to mass produce. So the food industry, needing a more affordable substitute, started selling rapeseed oil. Unfortunately, the rapeseed oil caused muscular heart lesions, and the acid in it was found to be poisonous to the degree that insects avoided it. Rapeseed oil is also the source of a notorious chemical warfare agent, mustard gas. The U.S. banned rapeseed in 1956 when thousands of soldiers and civilians experienced blistered lungs and skin. Rapeseed oil also lubricated steam engines and ships due to its unique ability to adhere to wet metal. In 1964, the food industry collaborated with both the chemical and nuclear industries in an attempt to reduce the toxicity levels of rapeseed. It took the food industry over a decade and a tremendous amount of genetic engineering to get rapeseed oil to be acceptable to the U.S. market. In the late 1970s, it was introduced with a genetic treatment involving cracking open seeds. Canadian plant breeders developed a variation of rapeseed that produced a monounsaturated oil low in this particular toxic acid. And the name was changed, and that's how we ended up with canola. And ola, O-L-A, meaning oil, and creating the name canola oil. And canola, the first three letters, C-A-N, actually came to mean Canada. So it's Canada oil. Now, prior to the late 1970s, the food oil industry collaborated with the American Heart Association, departments of nutrition at major universities, and numerous government agencies to advocate polyunsaturated oils as being heart healthy. This was in contrast to the false hardening of the arteries affected by saturated fats. However, by the late 1970s and early 80s, the cooking oil industry in North America had a huge dilemma. The consumption of polyunsaturated fats, meaning corn oil, soybean oils in particular, were directly connected to numerous inflammatory health complications, namely cancer and heart disease. Subsequently, as a result of this problem, the food industry had to discontinue using large volumes of polyunsaturated oils and no longer made claims of the oils being healthy. Furthermore, manufacturers would not resume the use of traditional healthy saturated fats, butter, lard, tallow, palm oil, and coconut oil, mainly due to their narrow profit margins. During the early 1980s, canola oil began an initial marketing campaign in the United States. In order to receive a full green light to move forward, the oil needed a GRAS, generally recognized as a safe approval from the Food and Drug Administration. GRAS rating awards typically go to food and herbal products with a history of no known adverse effects. However, canola oil was a new product and had no previous history, although it was associated with a banned product known for having lethal side effects. On the other hand, rapeseed oil was never granted GRAS approval. A change in the regulation needed to take place before canola oil could be marketed in the United States. We still do not know exactly what happened, but GRAS was granted canola oil in 1985. The rumor mill churned such tales, citing that the Canadian government, as a result, had a $50 million deficit in its, but we don't know. That's just rumor. Originally, canola oil was invented through a basic laboratory breeding and selection techniques in bioengineering. Genetically modified crops are a combination of the DNA of two or more different species that cannot naturally reproduce together, like a chicken and celery stalk. Such frankenfood can never occur in nature, even by random mutation. Today, most canola oil comes from genetically engineered seeds that are so far deviated from the natural rapeseed that it can be patented. Around 82% of the world's canola oil crops are currently genetically engineered to resist Roundup. Monsanto presently owns patents on the Roundup Ready canola seed, and farmers can be sued for not using the seed or having unauthorized canola plants in their fields. Now, even though it may be true that canola oil is high in monounsaturated fats, ranging from 55 to 65% of monounsaturated fats and between 28 and 35% of polyunsaturated fat, the polyunsaturated component of the canola is caused by major concern. The oil is extremely unstable under heat, light, and pressure, which causes oxidation and releases free radicals inside the body. Canola oil produces high levels of benzene and formaldehyde and other related compounds when heated, which becomes infused with the cooking food. All traces of omega-3 fats are essentially gone. Moreover, in the canola oil, when it undergoes heavy manufacturing and processing and abrasive refining and degumming and bleaching and deodorization, all using high heat and questionable chemicals before the final product is created. To sum up, if you've watched the different commercials out there, canola oil is heavily promoted. Okay, fine. And much of that I would agree with. What they have done, however, is there is also a certified organically grown rapeseed from which canola oil is made. I have not seen any studies on that to determine what its nutritional values are. What I do recommend, however, is use the oils that we have a long, thorough history of. Until such studies can be provided for other oils, I would look at coconut oil is your number one oil for cooking. Second would be mustard seed oil. And the third would be macadamia. Why? Because when you're heating something, ideally you should heat it at a low temperature. Even if you have to boil water, you can boil water, turn off the flame, and then put broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, asparagus in, and let it steep for no more than a minute and a half to 2 minutes. But the flame is off. The water's no longer boiling. Take it out. All that is done is the hydrolyzing of the heat on the plant has broken open the tough fibers. Then you run cold water over it, which you blanch it. Now you have a nice, crisp vegetable that you're putting in your refrigerator to use in a salad, but at least when you eat it, it will be digestible. The nutrients will be released in indole-3-carbinol, the isothiocyanates, all these wonderful sulforaphanes, all the chemicals that make broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, anti-cancer, pro-immune, helping to defeat a lot of toxic molecules. It makes it more bioavailable. Because one of the areas that is not discussed much is you can eat a food, but are you actually digesting it? And if you are, how much is digested? When your stomach is over full because you've eaten everything on your plate or more, then it's a mess. You may have simple sugars in that stomach with complex carbohydrates, with animal proteins, with animal fats. There's no way that that's going to be properly digested, absorbed, and utilized and eliminated. But if you were to eat small food, amounts of food at a given time, and you were to eat them without the heavy cooking, and you were to eat them in the right combinations, then you get maximum digestion, maximum utilization, and easy and highly efficient elimination. That's the ideal. But we don't live in an ideal world. Even when our intents are to do the right thing, we can fall short. So I always suggest that you have a plan B, which I call the compensating factor, which means that if I start my day with a really healthy smoothie and let's say lunchtime comes and you may be busy and you may not have time for a relaxing, healthy meal, take with you something that will be a grazing snack or a juice is always preferable. And that'll get you for the next couple hours through that period. You won't have a fluctuation in your blood sugar. You'll feel good. You'll be energized. You'll have good nutrients in your body and healthy blood. You'll be purifying your system and protecting your DNA and rebuilding bad DNA. All because you took the time to plan ahead. just like after workout. You may have a long workout or a short workout, a really good workout or a painful workout, but what you're going to need after every workout are your antioxidants. Vitamin C, 1,000, 2,000 milligrams, 1 to 200 units of coenzyme Q10, 400 units of vitamin E, 500 to 1,000 milligrams of calcium and magnesium. So that way, you've compensated. And people are surprised by how little food I eat when I eat out. Well, because I graze through the day, small amounts. And so you're never full. If you're never full, then your body's not overwhelmed. You're going to maximize the digestion of what you have. And when you're using light heat, using the quality oils that will handle higher heat, so you're not going to end up causing a toxic reaction in the oil. And then for the oils you want to put on your salads, cold-pressed, organic, extra virgin olive oil would be at the top of the list. But then you've got walnut oil, avocado oil, and almond oil are also outstanding to use. Use those oils that are extra virgin and unprocessed. Those are your best oils. They're a little more expensive, much better for you. And just stay away from any of the oils that are popular, but you don't have the science to back up their health uses. And why use any oil if there's not good science? Now, that's for a health-conscious person. Imagine a person going in right now, and we broadcast every day live, Monday through Friday at noon Eastern Time, and that's when a lot of people take their lunch break. Right now, there are people in taxi cabs, there are people, school teachers sitting in the parking lot, there are people who've gone out to their car because they've gotten feedback from thousands of people and listen to the show. And hopefully they have a healthy brown bag lunch they've taken, juicing, and they're relaxing, enjoying it, and being empowered by it. Keep this in mind. For every one of those, there's 100 or 1,000 people who are going over to a fast food place and getting french fries. How high was the temperature the oil was heated at? What type of oil is it? How long has it been used? Isn't that oil looked under a microscope very similar to the consistency of varnish? Yes. Is it good for your stomach lining? No. Is it good for anything? Nothing. Is it harmful, causing free radicals? Yes. Is it pro-inflammatory? Yes. And that's just the oil. That doesn't even include the French fries or the deep-fried fish or the fried chicken or whatever else may be fried in that, which is also abundantly unhealthy. So the average American is doing almost everything wrong when it comes to eating. And we need to be understanding, patient, and putting information out for those who are interested in examining it. If they're not, that's okay. Because the day will come when they'll realize they need to make a change. And finally, from Tufts University School of Medicine, this is a good article. It says, quote, coconut oil may be effective at combating infection with Candida albicans, according to a study published in the American Society of Microbiology's M-Sphere. The study found that coconut oil consumption reduced gastrointestinal colonization of C. albicans in this experiment. Quote, we found that diet can be an effective way to reduce the amount of candida in the mouse. The extension of this study is the human population is something that needs to be addressed in the future. Really? Well, first of all, it's a good study, so I appreciate that Tufts University School of Medicine did it. But there are those of us, and there are thousands of us, educators, qualified, and clinicians, who have been advocating a non-candida, non-yeast dietary approach to health for decades. Dr. Crook used to come on this program from Alabama, and he was probably the world's leading authority on candida, William Crook. And talking about candida, and he talked about coconut oil way back in the 1970s. So it's okay to not be aware of what else is going on in the world if you just try to get all your reality from one little piece of the puzzle of life. But at least it was a valuable piece, and we appreciate you sharing it. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment, Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. Have some additional things to share. This is from our environmental section, and it's from Common Dreams. Declining snowpack threatens water supply for billions worldwide. Water managers in a lot of places may need to prepare for a world where the snow reservoirs no longer exist. Quote, vast areas of the Northern Hemisphere that are home to nearly 2 billion people face dangerous water shortages due to shrinking snowpacks, according to a new study released today. Less snowfall and earlier melting over the last century has caused this, and they're looking at big reductions and the consequences of those big reductions. And they're using different climate models, and a U.S. team and a European team predicted future change in snow and rain runoff. And they said the Rio Grande Valley in Texas and Mexico and Spain, Portugal, in central Italy, and all across the Himalayan areas. And they're looking at these major, huge basins. There's 68 of them that have spring and summer runoff that is insufficient to meet human water demand, even without accounting for increase in demand that is likely to arise from population growth. Quote, we did not know where snow was critical to supplying water for people, and thus where people are most likely to be sensitive to projected snow changes. Many of the basins that are currently snow-dependent have large risks of decline in snow future potential to supply current demands, given both changes in rainfall and snowpack. Now, in lay language, here's what this means. Let's say that you're out in California, as I was recently, and doing a lecture before a group of physicians, and I noticed that there was no snowpack in the Sierra Madres, and I had asked the driver who lived in the area, and he said, we only have a trickle coming out of there. And it's true. Well, if you get a lot of your water going down this 450-mile canal that supplies farms and cities, communities, and now that's down to a trickle, that means they're not going to get that. It also means you have to rely upon other aquifers or the Little Colorado. And the Little Colorado is running out of water. Why? Because the snow that normally would be very deep, like 6, 8, 10 foot thick, in the Rockies isn't, and hence there's no snow to melt into water, and that's what's happening in a lot of states in the West in particular. But then you go to the Himalayas and you see that thousands of feet that would normally be covered at this time of year in snowpack is empty, no snow at all. So that means less water being melted in the Himalayas, and that feeds India and China and Vietnam. So you have a lot of major waterways affecting billions of people. They're running low on water. And as a result, it diminishes the amount of drinking water. And then you have all over the Middle East countries, major countries like Saudi Arabia, out of water and where are they supposed to get it? They don't have it. They can't drill for it. They've tried that. It's just not there. Doesn't matter how much money you have to drill. If you don't have water where you're drilling, you don't get water. And so they're having to rely upon desalinization, but there's enormous amount of pollution, enormous cost, but also you'd have to have at least, you know, 200 to 300 of those desalinization plants to supply just Saudi Arabia and to get as far from the coast where the people need it. So we're trying to make deserts into oases. We did that in California, Nevada, and Arizona. It's not working, and it won't be for the future. So when we talk about climate change causing migration, we're going to see that in the United States. Already, I had a person approach me a couple weeks ago in the park on a Sunday morning and wanted just to share a thought with me. And I said, what's that? He said, 20 years ago, I came to a homesteading lecture you were giving over on 92nd Street. I learned a lot from it, and I actually went out. But I didn't go to the areas you were suggesting. I went because I had a place with a friend that I could buy inexpensive, beautiful land in New Mexico. Had a wonderful time there until one day, nothing came out of the tap. Went out, did reports, found out that I would have to spend upwards of $100,000 to get down to enough water to be able to sustain the place. So my gardens dried up, all the vegetation dried up, and I finally had to, in effect, abandon the place because no one's going to buy a place without water. Said, I wished I would have listened, let other people know that they better do their homework and do hydrology reports whenever they move. So I envision right now, over the next, realistically, I would say the next 5 years, probably 10% of the population of California relocating. I also see people in most of Texas. There's only one part of Texas that you don't have a problem with water. In fact, you get abundance of it. That's northeast Texas, going towards Louisiana and Arkansas. But the rest of Texas, out of water. In fact, they were having to boil water in Houston. You don't have enough. Now, you have lots of money, then you can bring water from another place. But if you have the political support and the economic support of private venture capitalists to put $800 million, $1 billion into a water pipe and get the state to use their laws to get you across to other people's land, you're taking the water from someone, a large group of people, to give it to another group of people who have more power. And that's what you're going to see. You're going to see the diminishment of smaller suburban and rural communities in all these parched areas because the people who have the political power and the economic power will bring the water, what's left, to them. But there's still a finite amount. So we're running out of water in 20 states in the United States. Now, these states all have advantages in living there, but there's no advantage when you don't have water. And for those of you invested in Nevada and the gaming industry, that's going to be a ghost town in 10 years. There won't be any water for them. So that's the reality. And all I can do is share what I see based upon my research. So look around you, look where you'd likely be, and look where you can be in an environment that can be self-sufficient. And there's lots of wonderful places that have abundant water, good soil. They're not near nuclear power plants. We don't have a shortage of good places to live. We just don't like moving. We don't like change. We want to keep living in a desert and expect the desert to be hospitable to us. It won't be. And you won't have a complete abandonment of any state or any environment. But you will not have the continued growth nor the support for industry, agriculture, and domestic use. That is an absolute certainty. If it's 25% water reduction right now, mandatory in California, it'll go to 50% within a year. And you're going to see the biggest collapse in the real estate market in the world in California and Nevada and Arizona in the next 5 years. From Martha Rosenberg from Op-Ed News, quote, the nomination of the drug industry funded Robert M. Califf for FDA commissioner is a slap in the face of every honest doctor, researcher, and regulator, and the public that puts its trust in the FDA. It makes a mockery of concerns about conflicts of interest, transparency in the industry firewalls, and the regulatory process itself. A disclosure statement on the website of the Duke Clinical Research Institute, which Califf has directed, lists 25 drug companies Califf received research funds from, including drug giants Johnson & Johnson, Eli Lilly, Merck, Schering Plough, and GlaxoSmithKline. Califf has gone on record that collaboration between industry and regulators is a good thing. He told NPR, quote, "Many of us consult with a pharmaceutical industry, which I think is a very good thing. They need ideas, and then the decision about what they do is really up to the person who is funding the study," end quote. What? What did you say? He is known for defending Vioxx, which is reported to have caused between 500,000 deaths down to 50,000 deaths from heart attacks and events before its withdrawal. And Merck is said to have known about Vioxx cardio effects, but marketed the blockbuster drug in any case. And I interviewed Dr. David Graham, who was the overseer of that project at the FDA, and he blew the whistle, and they attacked him when he said, "You're going to have an increase in stroke and heart attack if you use Vioxx." Well, they didn't listen to him. The FDA never demanded the drug be withdrawn. Now think of that. The biggest crime in medical history, the most deaths from any drug, the worst compliance oversight in the history of the FDA, and not one person in the FDA was reprimanded for that, except for the doctor who actually exposed this and knew that Eli Lilly knew it was dangerous, Dr. David Graham. So Califf was instrumental in the Duke drug trial for the blood thinner that he cheerleaded for the drug, despite medical experts' objections to its approval and the results, 379 subsequent deaths. Duke itself, Duke University, is still recovering from a major research fraud scandal that resulted in terminated grants, retracted papers, and a 60-minute special. It is the least appropriate place from which to choose an FDA commissioner. The FDA already is the drug industry handmaiden, smiling on questionable new drugs and new drug approvals only to issue warnings or withdraw them after billions were made. Remember Vioxx, Baycol, Trovan, Merdia, Celdane, Histamol, and Darvon. They are not around anymore. Why? Remember the popularity of statins, brand names, asthma, and psychiatric drugs, and GERD drugs? Once they went off patent, the FDA discovered serious side effects only after they were off patent and began listing warnings. Well, under Califf, the Wall Street toadying at the price of public health will get worse, if that's possible. In fact, the same mindset of a collegial relationship between members of Congress, the FDA, and the drug company just oozes. And as a result, the FDA never goes up against the drug companies. Remember, it was former Governor Rick Perry's chief of staff leaning on Perry to vaccinate all the state's girls with the Merck drug Gardasil, the vaccine. And that's where he was. He was the person advocating that. Why don't we have all the dead children's parents in Texas go to Congress and put pictures of your daughters and their names and say, "I had a healthy daughter who deserved a life, and because of Dr. Califf and counseling Rick Perry, she's dead today." FDA advisory panels, whose recommendations the FDA usually follows, are supposed to include patient representatives to see that the public's interests are balanced against the big pharma consultants. So many doctors and researchers now live on 5- and 6-digit drug company stipends, and the FDA actually relaxed conflict of interest rules a few years ago. And as a result, you have no patient representatives. That's a sham. So just keep in mind, the new commissioner of the FDA would be probably the worst in history. I suggest this audience contact the president for appointing him and your legislative member and say, do not allow this person to be our FDA commissioner. There's some outstanding, qualified physicians, scientists who would make good commissioners representing the people's interest first. In a moment, my guest standing by, but I also wanted to mention something. I saw some films recently, and I thought that these films that could really help people. One was Trumbull, based upon the life of Dalton Trumbull, the great screenwriter, probably the greatest screenwriter in Hollywood history. He wrote Spartacus. He wrote Exodus. He wrote many, Johnny Get Your Gun. And he won Academy Awards for some of this, but he was blacklisted because of his views. And it's an outstanding film. It's based upon a true story. I also saw a film called Truth. It's based upon the final investigation that Dan Rather's group did at CBS, that they had to rescind some of the statements. Now, it was because of the political backlash of people on the right. It was not because they made mistakes and could not validate their statements. The basic story was a relatively insignificant story about George Bush when he was in the National Guard and how he wasn't there and how he got all these special exemptions. And it just exposed this. Not a big deal. But one of the people was pressured to recant some of the statements, and then it caused them to have to quit. But it was some good reporting, and the movie is based upon that particular episode. And one really harrowing story based upon a true incident is at the Lincoln Plaza. And it's based upon a young idealistic prosecutor in Germany in 1957 who is asked to investigate one prison guard and the abuse of that prison guard at Auschwitz. And he didn't know a thing about Auschwitz. In fact, everyone he asks in the prosecutor's office knows nothing. And in fact, everyone he asks knows nothing about Auschwitz, as if no German knew anything about the most notorious concentration camp ever. And the film is how he opens up this case and won't let go of it. The consequences to the entire German population. Everybody wanted that story not to exist. Nobody wanted to acknowledge that their parents, their fathers, their mothers had participated in supporting the Nazi regime, the party. And it's based upon a true story and how he actually had the ability to arrest Mengele, Joseph Mengele, who was the butcher and the doctor who did all these human experiments on twins. And Mengele would come from South America to his home in Germany regularly. And everyone knew it. The police knew it. Nobody would issue an arrest warrant. Everyone blocked it. And when I'm watching these films, the most emotional film that I've watched was Spotlight. It was based upon the 2001, a true story of how a reporter was looking at a priest who had molested someone in the parish in Cardinal Law's parish in Boston, and he wanted to look at the story. And how everyone in the Boston Globe and outside all wanted to keep it quiet. And it's the true story how they stayed on the case and they finally broke it. The Boston Globe broke it. And then I think in January of 2002, it went public. In any case, what happens in all these is that you have so many people knowing the truth and nobody wanting to act on it. The lawyers, the business community, people don't want to look at the truth. In their own institutions, there's something they're associated with. There was one scene in the Spotlight where one of the people said, how can people not know that these crimes against these kids happened? And one of the people said, what if they all know? And the truth was, they all knew. But they wanted to cover it up. They didn't want to hurt the church. And as a result, it was covered up. And by the way, it was covered up clear up to the Pope, who was the head cardinal at the time running the Vatican. It was Pope Benedict who became, Ratzinger, who became, the Pope himself. but he was responsible for taking thousands of priests, thousands, and hiding them around the world in parishes and quietly paying hush money. There was a whole cottage industry and lawyers settling lawsuits because of this. Now, what I thought, and I had a conversation with someone in Pacifica when I was walking from the movie, I said, why is it that we individually, as producers, as hosts, why is it that we as a foundation chartered by Lewis Hill, why is it we have been able to expose, and rightly so, crimes against humanity by institutions and individuals, yet we refuse to look at our own crimes? Why? What would the audience do if it knew that there was a massive sexual harassment and suits been settled? What would they do if they knew the misappropriation of copyrighted material, major violations of the law, serious law? What would they do if they knew that someone came to me and reported being sexually assaulted and multiply raped along with other women, and I took that information to Pacifica's top people and nothing was done? What would they do if they knew of all the other problems that exist? And why haven't we ever investigated openly and honestly the privatization of the most valuable asset in Pacifica's history, Democracy Now? Why have the left, why have the liberal community refused to be honest for 1 second in its entire existence in examining its own frauds, its own commissions and omissions? Do we not have the courage? Are we that hypocritical? Then shame on us in our demise, our reduction in audience, our begging for funds. It's all part of the same picture. If we had honest, diligent people in command, they would have cleaned house long ago, apologized for what we have done, and set a course that we would not allow this kind of behavior to exist. One of the chief characters in the movie Spotlight, which I hope you see because you'll become as outraged as I am, said, I don't want to go after a priest. I don't want to go after a group of priests. I'm going to go see if this is institutional. That's what the story is. And indeed, it was institutional in the Catholic Church. So why can't we ask, what is dysfunctional, illegal, criminal in the institution of Pacifica? Do we have the courage to do that? I hope so. Or we don't have a foundation in the future. I have sent all of this in detail, fully documented, to the leaders of the Pacifica Foundation, including 5 separate executive directors. I hope they act on it. If they don't, I promise you, I give you my word, I will, in the very near future. So listen carefully, friends. You may turn on this radio program and not hear me on our beloved station. That is the likely outcome. But will I back down? I will not. Will I take these people to court? I will. Will I make this a major issue? I don't give a damn about the guys who refuse to call something what it is because they're afraid of how it might impact public perception. Our public perception is not good right now because we betrayed our listeners by taking their money and not fulfilling their orders in a timely or at all manner, and because we've had some bad programming, bad management, and a whole lot of bad governance. Isn't it time we had the courage to change? If we do not have the courage to change, then we shouldn't exist. We don't deserve that right. We should stop taking it for granted that we have a right every day to broadcast if we're not doing something that is meaningful, relevant, empowering. So the next time you don't hear me, then you'll know why. Because my truth would be too much for them to handle. But if they think taking me off the air would stop what I'm about to do, they should come and sit on the meetings with me and my attorneys. And they'll see, I'm no one to piss with, friends. Trust me. Trust me on this. I don't bluff and I don't back off. It's time we change the entire damn institution and held those responsible who have abused it, who've used it, and I intend to do exactly that. Enough said. So, listen to this phone number, 712-775-6850. 712-775-6850. You can always hear me there, because on my network, we don't censor, We don't have these stupid agendas. You're empowered. Let's say hello to my guest standing by, Ned Sublow.
Hello.
Hi, Ned.
Hello. Hi, Gary.
Do you think I made my point there, Ned?
I was impressed with the force with which you delivered it.
Good. Ned, I'd like for you to share some of your insights with us on the relevant stories that we have not been told. We've understood, of course, in this audience in particular, about the slavery. Slaves were imported in the United States and purchased and owned by wealthy plantation owners to man the fields for produce and commodities to be sold on the market. Then comes the Civil War and the slaves were freed. End of story. No, it wasn't. And there's this other half of the slave story, and there's another far more heinous side that is left untold in school history books and whose repercussions continue today in our ghettos, and the rate of incarceration of African Americans in our prison system in general, and increasingly now prison labor. And that story concerns how the U.S. built its power and domestic wealth on its own slave industry. So I feel a good place to start is January 1st, 1808, which is increasingly a date that we must pay attention to. It's one of the key dates in U.S. history because it marks the transition of the U.S. being simply an importer of slaves to becoming a breeder of slaves. And this is the economy that brought the U.S. to its geopolitical power in the 19th century. So please begin with detailing this transition from slave importer to slave breeder, and also the two different slave industries competing between South Carolina and Virginia. The forum is yours.
Certainly. When we wrote our book, which is called The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry, we wrote a new history of the United States that takes into account the notion that slavery is central to U.S. history. We know it is. It's not a sidebar. It's not only possible but necessary to write the history of the United States with slavery firmly at the center. And once you understand that slavery in the United States, and previously to a degree in the colonial era, was a slave breeding system, then it becomes necessary to reevaluate key events and figures and actions in American history. So that was kind of the rationale behind our book. Now, specifically in terms of 1808 and why we feel it's such a vital date for everyone to know, January 1st, 1808, this date's in the Constitution as a result of a compromise between Virginia and, well, really the South Carolina delegates who were insistent on writing a 20-year protection for the foreign slave trade into the Constitution, which in fact they did, Article 1, Section 9, that says that the importation of such persons as states shall think proper to admit, you know, can't be prohibited before January 1st, 1808, the only date in the Constitution. Didn't say that the foreign slave trade had to be prohibited as of January 1st, 1808, but that it could not be. As it played out, it was indeed prohibited at the first constitutionally permissible date, January 1st, 1808, through the proactivity of President Thomas Jefferson. Now, at this point, necessary to point out that President Jefferson was, of course, a Virginian, and that this entire clause had come about as the result of the clash of interests between Virginia, the great slave breeder, and South Carolina, the great slave importer, over who would get the concession to sell slave labor to the plantation empire to come that was in its early stages of taking shape in what we now call the Deep South. In Virginia, the conditions existed for a slave breeding industry because, unlike the rest of the hemisphere, which was so heavily invested in sugar, in Virginia, the enslaved did not die off and have to be replaced immediately by fresh arrivals from Africa, but lived long enough to have families reproduce so that Virginia's slave population, and Maryland's as well, grew by what at the time they called natural increase. Meanwhile, Virginia's tobacco land is largely played out through over-farming by the time of the Declaration of Independence. The most profitable thing for Virginia slave owners to do with their growing slave labor population was to sell adolescents down south to the newly opened territories. South Carolina, on the other hand, was at a disadvantage because South Carolina, where slaves typically did not live that long on the rice plantations, South Carolina was an importer. So these two interests clashed at the Constitutional Convention, as one of the South Carolina delegates says. Virginia has everything to gain by stopping the importations. Her slaves will rise in value. This comes back in a curious echo decades later at the writing, in secret, of course, of the Confederate Constitution, which retains the prohibition against African imports. Why? Because South Carolina, the leader of the secession project, was giving Virginia a carrot and a stick to join the Confederacy or not. If Virginia had remained out of the Confederacy, and the Confederacy prohibited the importation of persons, as the Constitution called it, then Virginia would be without a market for what was still, all those decades later, a major industry of exporting people. Had Virginia joined the Confederacy, which ultimately it did, Virginia would have had a protected market, because prohibiting the African slave trade was protectionism for a domestic slave-raising and slave-harvesting industry.
Outstanding overview. I appreciate that. Can you explain how this economy of breeding human beings ruled as merchandise and collateral, which was not based upon any gold standard, but was tied to paper and credit, operated, and what kind of wealth was generated from this economy?
That's right. There was no gold or silver to speak of in the South. There was no hard coin. Paper money, especially after Andrew Jackson got through the Second Bank of the United States and destroyed it, paper money was issued by any one of 1,600 different banks, which might go under at any moment. Many of them had as capital just the paper of other banks. And the farther you got away from the bank that issued the paper money you held, the less likely it was to be valuable, the more it was like making a foreign exchange transaction, and it was, as they call it, then discounted, so that the farther away you got from the issuing bank, your money lost its value. There was no industry in the South to invest in, because slavery was contrary to having industry. Slavery drove out everything else. The 60-80% of the wealth of many of the large slave owners was in the form of their slave holdings. Slaves could always be sold. There was always a market for them. They could be liquidated more easily than anything else, turned to cash more easily than anything else. So slaves basically became human savings accounts. If a planter made money with a crop, the best thing to do with those profits was to lock it down in purchasing more slaves, so that the people, the black people of the South, were literally part of the money supply. A child born in the 1850s might be worth $100 at birth, might be worth $75, depending on where they were at the exact moment. That meant not that the child was about to be sold for that amount of money. It meant that the slave owner had that much more credit at the bank or from his mortgager. So and as modern monetary theory would explain, the creation of new credit is actually the creation of new money. So the growth from a mere 389,000 Africans initially brought to the present-day United States to 4 million enslaved people as of 1860, 3.9 million something, was itself an economic expansion. That is to say that those 4 million enslaved people represented a vast sum of money on the books. This included 57% of the people of South Carolina who were carried on the books as property of others.
Ned, just hold 1 second, because a lot of our land-based stations that carry only the 1 hour of the program are signing off, but we're continuing on the Progressive Radio Network to complete this interview, and people can continue by going to progressiveradionetwork.com or prn.com. For everyone else, we thank you for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Please continue, Ned.
let's see, where was I?
The percentage of people living who were slaves as a percentage of the population.
Right. Yeah. So this vast amount of wealth on paper was actually the population, the enslaved population of the South. And that means that the Emancipation Proclamation, right, January 1st, 1863, most revolutionary document in American history, because it suddenly declared this class of property that had always existed to be worthless. You got to understand that this money carried on the books as being money, when actually it was people, when labor was capital, was such that Mississippi, I mean, the Southerners were not just wealthy slave-owning Southerners. Slave-owning Southerners were fabulously wealthy. Mississippi had the highest number of millionaires per capita in the country until slavery ended, and then Mississippi became the poorest state because slaves were all the wealth Mississippi ever had.
For the typical African-American woman who was sold as a breeder to sustain the U.S. slave market, what would life have been like, and how large was the scope of this industry?
The Industrial Revolution, right, which a vast economic expansion like nothing ever before seen on Earth, right, powered by cotton from the South. This cotton from the South made financiers, insurance companies, shippers in New York wealthy. It made planters wealthy. The burden of production ultimately went to the what we call the capitalized womb, the wombs of enslaved women, because cotton acreage could only increase as fast as enslaved women could have babies, plus 17 years. Okay, women, to achieve this, and to this end, enslaved women were pressured to have babies as early as possible, as often as possible, until they couldn't produce babies anymore, at which point they might well find themselves like 55-year-old Minerva Granger, who had worked for Thomas Jefferson, appraised as being worth nothing. The penalty, the most common way that this pressure was exerted, was the threat that a woman who did not produce children would be sold to the South, which was generally considered to be the worst thing that could happen. If, however, she was a, quote, good breeder, close quote, her children would suffer that fate instead.
Ned, thank you for this introduction to this topic. You've given us enough of an overview. The material can be read in depth in a very scholarly and important, easily read, The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry. It's an epic-sized history of this problem. And Ned's last name is Shubletteee. And Ned, I'd like to invite you back for 1 hour, just you and I talking about this on our Progressive Commentary Hour on Tuesday evening, 7 to 8 p.m., because you have a lot more to share, and I want to get into all the nuances of this now that we've given the big overview.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Look forward to it. Coming up Tuesday, 7 p.m., Progressive Commentary Hour, a continuation of an interesting look on slavery and how the history of the U.S. economy was built upon slavery and the slave breeding industry. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening. I look forward to seeing you back here tomorrow. Have a nice day.